Hey everyone, this is Carrie Champion, the host of Naked Sports.
The all-new 2025 Nissan Armada Pro 4X provides freedom. Freedom to explore, to go wherever you want, with your whole crew and all your toys. With a twin-turbo V6 engine, 8,500 pounds of towing capacity, and seating for eight, this unshakable fortress of a vehicle is built to take you on your next adventure. Drive the all-new 2025 Nissan Armada today. Learn more at nissanusa.com. Intelligent four-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.
Does Friendly have a taste? If it does, it's probably like Hello's peppermint-flavored anti-plaque and whitening toothpaste. Brush away plaque, show tartar who's boss, and remove surface stains to naturally whiten. Hello's thoughtful and flavor-forward products make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party. So say hello to Hello with the always cruelty-free, never tested on animals toothpaste that's made to spread smiles. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
All right. Thank you, counsel. After the sidebar, I'll suggest we have the witness take the stand. And if there's a proposed offering of an exhibit, we'll take that up after the witness has been on the stand and under oath. So I know they were in the courtroom, Dr. Hampikian, as they go ahead and have him brought in, please.
Solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you God.
I do.
Good morning.
Morning.
Would you state your name and spell your last name for the record?
I'm Greg, G-R-E-G, Hampikian, H-A-M as in Mary, P as in Peter, I-K-I-A, N as in Nancy.
Okay. And it's Dr. Hampikian, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, in full disclosure, we do know each other, don't we?
From this case, yes.
Okay. And how would you prefer, for purposes of this hearing, that I address you as either your first name, or was Dr. Hampikian what you would prefer?
Probably given the formality, Dr. Hampikian's okay. What I'm used to.
So, Dr. Hampikian, can you briefly explain to me your occupation?
I'm a professor at Boise State University. I have a laboratory there. We work on a lot of DNA projects, forensics, viruses, cancer, and I have a joint appointment. So I'm in the biology department, but I have a joint appointment in criminal justice so that I can take on some of their students for projects, occasionally lecture over there. And then I'm an adjunct lecturer at the University of Idaho College of Law. And then I also consult on cases like this, which are private cases. And I head up something called the Forensic Justice Project that deals with testing DNA in cases where people write in and say they're innocent, they've been convicted wrongfully.
And in that regard, with your forensics project, is that a nationally renowned project or organization?
It's funded nationally. We work right now in, I think, a dozen states, and we have a grant from the Department of Justice. They don't endorse anything I say. I always have to say that about my funding agencies, to work in five states in particular, doing DNA reviews of cases.
Okay. And there's no particular distinction. You will do work for defense work and you will do work for prosecution work. Is that fair?
Sure. Yes.
And have you testified previously in cases regarding DNA analysis?
Yes. Dozens of times. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And can you briefly explain to me your educational background?
I have a PhD in genetics, a bachelor's in biology, a master's in genetics, all from the University of Connecticut in Storrs. I've had postdoctoral training after that on a National Science Foundation grant in Australia, working on the Y chromosome, the male chromosome, and then more postdoctoral training in Massachusetts in developmental biology, and a lot of professional development around forensics. And that's mostly done through the American Academy of Forensic Sciences or some of our annual meetings.
Is there any special accreditation or academic achievements that are recognized as part of your time doing DNA analysis?
The most important things are our publications. That's what we're judged by. So these are sent out for peer review. If two of the three editors think it's good, we might have to fix a few things and then it gets published. But I consider that the most important thing. And then we have certifications to put DNA in certain databases. There's a Y chromosome database. Of course, they have tenure at the university, which is another hoop. So there's lots of hoops we had to go through.
And this is not, this is Boise, Idaho that we're in, but you're an international, you're sought after in an international capacity. Would that be fair?
I don't
Objection
know.
Sought after. Bolstering the witness.
All right. First of all, can I'll be talking at the same time to keep clear record. When there's an objection made, please pause so the court can rule, and the court is going to sustain that objection.
Okay. Have you had an occasion to work with international police?
Yes. I've worked with the French police. My mother lived in France at the end of her life, and I had good relations with them. We actually published a case that we worked on. It was a big national case that had languished for many years. It was the first time that a type of DNA familial searching was used. So we published an article. And I've worked with the Taiwan Forensic Science Lab. And we also published a case. And that was a man who was wrongfully convicted with DNA analysis that we asked to review. And the lab did the laboratory wet work at our request. And then we wrote a report together and then published an article.
So not only is your organization do your own DNA analysis, you peer review others as well. Would that be fair?
Yeah. Right now, most of the work is review. It comes in on computer disks. So it's run at independent accredited forensic labs, mostly in America, a few international cases.
You mentioned the French case. Would that have been the Amanda Knox case?
No, Amanda was in Italy, and that's that right. Was that was a different case. The French case was Elodie Kulik.
Did you have any involvement in the Amanda Knox case?
I did have some involvement in that case. I worked on it for several years with the defense side, starting during the original trial where she was convicted, and then staying with it through to her ultimate exoneration.
And when you say ultimate exoneration, eventually she was, through part of your efforts with DNA, she was exonerated of the charges. Is that right?
Yes.
Objection, Your Honor, bolstering the witness.
Oh, hold on. There's an objection. I'm sustaining the objection, striking any answer that came after.
About how many cases... Well, before we get to that, about how long have you been doing this forensic DNA work?
Since about 1989.
Okay. And about how many cases have you worked on?
Work is a... Some of these cases take years and years of a lot of work, and some of them are just quick reviews, but I'm sure I'm in the hundreds by now.
Okay. And you already mentioned that you publish your work in peer-reviewed... journals, is that correct?
Yes, that's required really of the academic position.
And required of the as part of being affiliated in some capacity with Boise State?
They generally don't let you stay if you're not publishing. Yeah.
Okay. And then I think I mentioned this before, but I'll mention it again. You do work with the police on these cases as well. Is that correct?
Yes, particularly in cases where the state labs don't have the technology, and we have the technology, or they haven't yet validated the technology, and we can help the police. And a lot of what I'd call difficult DNA cases, where they're over 20 years old, say, and we're reopening them. So we have a lot of officers come to the lab.
You mentioned that, and that was where I was leading next, is there are instances where our own state lab doesn't have the facilities or the understanding to engage in certain testing that you have. Is that correct?
I wouldn't say they don't have the understanding, but they have a very difficult process. They have to validate, you may have heard from their experts, all of the techniques. I mean, it's a public lab, and so we're a research lab. We can kind of get to the newer technology more easily. And that's really the reason why I think people would come to us.
Okay. And you have testified in regards to helping the prosecution in cases as well. Is that correct?
I've been listed as a witness here in Idaho, didn't testify. I did testify in Atlanta, Georgia, and was paid by the Fulton County to testify.
As part of your... I'm sorry, I'll slow down. As part of your employment, is it part of your employment to train students who work in police forensic DNA laboratories?
Yes. I teach the forensic biology course. It's the only one at the university. And so several of my students have gone on and gotten jobs in forensic science in the laboratories. I have a graduate student who works in one of the with one of the police agencies right now. So a lot of people have come through the lab and end up in forensic science, some of them in state labs.
And in as part of your occupation as well, have you had the occasion to instruct and train judges on DNA analysis?
So judges come a lot of times to the professional development that I offer for all lawyers, but specifically I was invited twice to Montana to train the judges, and then once to Israel to train judges.
Okay. And has it had the occasion where you have helped solve what are referred to as cold cases?
Yes. I'd say the one I referred to in France is a notable example. And then Christopher Tapp, who was exonerated here in Idaho, we worked with the Idaho Falls Police Department to find a new DNA match who eventually confessed to the crime that Mr. Tapp had served wrongfully for. And there's a case now that's going on in Idaho where we helped the police establish a new match in a murder that was many decades old, but that's not finished yet.
Okay. And so when I make when I talk about what is called a cold case, mm-hmm. that means a case that occurred sometime previously?
It has several definitions. I like to think them as old cases that, you know, are just not getting a lot of movement forward. And some agencies will refer to them as cold cases. And there's actually special funding you can get from the Department of Justice that are aimed at solving these cases. So there are cases where there's no active suspect, and methods like genealogy, one of the new methods, can be used.
Okay. Do you have a DNA lab at your location?
Yes.
And is that a fully functioning DNA lab?
on good days, it's fully functioning. Yeah, it's a you know, it has the equipment that that's similar to the forensic equipment that the Idaho State Police Lab has. We're not doing active casework though. I send any evidence now to accredited independent labs, either the state lab or an independent lab. And that's mostly because I don't want everybody in the lab to get subpoenaed to come and work like something like this. And it's just easier. So for, you know, for somebody writing a check, they can take all the responsibility for everything that happens, handling wet lab items.
You mentioned the state lab. Has there been occasions when the state lab has reached out to you, the Idaho state lab has reached out to you to consult you on issues?
I don't think the state lab's reached out to me. We've talked, and I certainly know some of the analysts, but I can't remember them reaching out to me.
And you do teach forensic courses as well at Boise State?
I teach forensic biology at the law school. I teach a course called Wrongful Convictions that looks at how we reopen cases with DNA. So that's kind of a forensics class. And periodically, I'll teach seminars on forensics.
And how often would you say that you testify?
You know, 5-6 times a year, maybe, or less.
Okay. Is there a reason or an understanding as to why you don't testify more often?
I mean, most times if I review a case, I'm getting a bunch of data and I can run it through our software and check on things, and I go through all the records. And if I'm not contributing something new that someone has hired me to look at, they're not probably going to want to pay for more time for me to come and sit in a courtroom. So oftentimes, if I agree with what the lab has done and there's no questions, I'm not called to testify. And that's the vast majority of cases.
And would you describe your profession as a specialized scientific profession?
Yes.
And it takes specialized knowledge?
Yes.
And with your education and training, are there a number of people who obtain your specialized knowledge in this field?
I mean, I get to meet with my colleagues. I'm a fellow of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. There's a few thousand people there. And then I'm going to another professional meeting in June, different one, and there'll be a few hundred people there, hopefully, when I get to speak as well.
And you're speaking there?
Yeah.
Are there any special certifications that are required to do what you do?
Certifications. I mean, I have to, anytime we do anything at the university, there's two oversight boards that we have to apply to. They have questions about our methodology in terms of humans, like, are we compromising anybody's rights? Are we doing any experiments that would, you know, abuse somebody in some way or abuse their rights? And then I have to go through the biology safety committee, and they also review everything. And then every year we have to go through all of our training again to be certified to continue the research. So,
and in order to do what you do, it's important that you maintain those certifications and training. Is that correct?
Me and everybody in my lab. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I want to talk to you a little bit about a concept of transferring DNA. Can you in general give me a broad overview of what the concept of transfer of DNA means?
So transfer is really at the center of DNA. You've probably heard of, you know, latent print evidence. It's very hard to transfer somebody's thumbprint from, you know, your glass to, say, a weapon. But DNA can move very easily, and so we always have to be cautious about making conclusions about how DNA got somewhere. So I like to say DNA is really good at telling us something about who may have contributed, but the how it got there, that's really for the triers of fact, for the jury or the judge. And as a DNA analyst, I can't tell. And the reason I can't tell is because DNA does move. It's how we get it. We take a swab, it just is a Q-tip, you wet it and you rub it on something. And then you take a dry swab and you rub it. And both of those, just like you might clean up a pudding stain or something from a kid on a cloth, you know, you transfer some of that material to your swabs, a wet swab and a dry swab. And then you have to get that material off the swab, and it's as easy as putting it in water with a few chemicals and the DNA comes off. So DNA moves around all the time. When we talk about touch DNA, a term I really don't like because it implies we know how it got somewhere, someone touched with their hand. But really, the way we get DNA on our hands, what the research shows is you touch your face, you know, you're washing your hands during the day, but you touch parts of your body, you know, you might scratch your ear, whatever. And all of those loose cells are transferred to your hands. So even what we call touch DNA is mostly transferred from somewhere else. So that's why I'm very cautious about speculating how DNA got anywhere. I don't know any better than anyone with common sense how DNA got somewhere. It's who could have contributed it.
Okay. So it's an issue of who contributed as to how it actually got there.
For me, yes. That's what I think is the limits of my ability.
And the fluidity of DNA, it can. There's a number of manners in which DNA can be transferred. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about touch and swabbing with a liquid. You could just sweat, and some of those cells will roll down with the sweat. So all the ways you can imagine dust, say, moving, DNA can move.
So you just mentioned that the manner in which dust can move, would that be the same manner in which DNA can move?
If it's dry and flaky, but DNA can also be in liquids. So yeah, it's it has a variety of ways of transferring.
So my touching of this microphone, potentially I could have placed my DNA on the speaker of this.
Likely you did. Whether it would be detected with a single swab or not, you know, I don't know. But yeah, we on contact, our cells are shedding all the time. So on contact, you're probably leaving a few.
So when you say something as likely as touching something, if you were to have any kind of contact with any particular item, is there a high likelihood or a good likelihood that that DNA would be transferred to that item?
Several levels to that question. You know, when did I wash my hands? How long did I touch it? How vigorously? Am I a shedder? Do I have psoriasis or dandruff? And so there's a lot of questions just about me and my contact with something or a person's contact. But then there's also the laboratory, what technique they're using. In my lab, we can detect down to a single cell, not 100% of the time, maybe 20% of the time or so, where we can get DNA from a single cell if we want to.
And I'm going to jump around a little bit before I get back to the single cell analysis. DNA and the transfer of DNA can be in relation to how much friction's involved with the surfaces. Would that be fair?
Yes.
And talk a little bit about that.
Just like when you want to rub something off your body or exfoliate, the more rubbing, obviously, the more raw you're going to make the skin. And the first thing that comes off is just an outer layer. That's all the dried keratinocytes. They kind of link together and they give you waterproofing. So that first layer goes. But if you keep scrubbing, you know, you'll get down to tissue. You'll get tissue fluid and then you'll get blood and you'll get other bits of tissue. So it depends how vigorous in terms of how far down you go, how many layers, and then also just the amount of friction, just like you'd imagine if you're filing your nails, more friction, more removal of biological material.
For those of us that don't have your significant knowledge in this area, I would like to talk a little bit about this concept of what, and if you could put it into some context, what is a single cell?
It's very small. You can't see it unless it's a human egg cell. You can actually see they're big enough to see. But the type of cells we're talking about, the epithelial cell, you have to have a microscope to see. And so you can transfer hundreds, or I'm told we transfer pounds of these skin cells. So we're leaving a lot of them and they're very small.
So you're leading into my next question because you can analyze down to a very minute cell that only can be detected with a microscope. Is that correct?
Yes.
But as humans, would it be fair to suggest that we are in a constant process of shedding a skin and our DNA at all times of the day?
Yes. Yeah.
So in all likelihood, as I walk around and if I'm shedding, my DNA is being placed all over this table, right?
Yes.
And even if I go to sit down in that chair, as a human, and the fact that we are human beings that are in a constant state of shedding, would my DNA also be transferred to that chair by sitting down on it?
It could, or if somebody else's DNA is on your pants because you sat somewhere where they, you know, had their hand in, you could transfer someone else's as well.
And in addition, if you were to pick up or hold an object of any kind, there'd be a high likelihood, a good likelihood. Is there any way to determine what the likelihood is of how your DNA and what DNA would be on that item that you would pick up?
In a laboratory setting, there's studies that are done. We've done them in my lab where, you know, you hold something quickly, you grab it and you rub it. We tried a bunch of different things. And I think it's kind of common sense about the trends. The more friction, the more time, the more transfer. But there are shocking things. Sometimes somebody handles something a lot and you get no DNA. Sometimes somebody just taps it and you get tons of DNA. So I don't know how to ascribe a likelihood in a, you know, crime situation or a field situation. Just those general rules about time and friction are important.
So if I understand your testimony correctly, there are a number of ways to transfer DNA onto an object. Would that be fair?
Yes.
There would be ways in which you would touch an item and physically have contact with it. That's one way, correct?
Correct.
There would be a suggestion that if you were just around the object and you were, like many humans, shedding your cells would naturally fall on or be present on anything that you might be around.
They could.
Your hair can fall out and be on something if you were to do that as well, just being in the vicinity.
Yes, common sense would.
Or if you were doing something rigorous or doing something in the form of an exercise and some of your hair comes out and falls, that's another way to track DNA.
Yeah, the hair is shedding like the skin and just more obviously.
So and if you're around something, there is a strong likelihood that your hair is shedding and then you're putting your DNA. Again, I could be putting my DNA on that chair by shedding, correct?
You could. And if we looked for what we call environmental DNA, I'm sure all of us who've been in this room, you know, have a high likelihood of showing up if the room is sampled really well.
And aside from DNA that falls off of your hair and falls off of our shedding bodies and skin, is there possible that DNA could also be transferred through our breath?
You know, there have been studies that show that, and now they're having like swabs outside of zoos and they're detecting all the animals who live in the zoo. So there is a certain amount of DNA that is transferred in the air. And that's really an area that people are developing right now.
Okay. So in other words, the breathing on some object, I'm not talking about any other fluids. We'll get to that in a second, but the breathing on an object, or if you're involved in a situation where you're engaging in heavy exertion, and as part of that heavy exertion, you're breathing onto an object, potentially there would be DNA of you on that as well, correct?
Potentially, yes.
Okay. And then we'll go to fluids. Mm-hmm. We can get DNA by way of perspiration, by sweating.
Yes.
If you're doing some sort of physical activity.
Yes.
And a drop of your sweat were to fall on an object, perspiration, that would be another way that you would find DNA on an object as well. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then by way of spitting, as much as disgusting as it might be, all of us have been guilty of being involved in situations where fluid comes out of our mouth and places itself on DNA, correct?
Correct.
And then as far as sneezing or breathing out of our nose, if we have any kind of a cold or any sort of issue with that, again, that's another way that DNA could be placed on an object. Is that correct?
Yes.
So would it be fair to say that there are a variety of ways and manners in which DNA can accumulate on any object that you are around?
Yes.
It could be by way of fluid, correct?
Correct.
It could be by way of air, through the air.
Yes.
It could be by way of hair.
Yes.
It could be by way of having a physical touch with the object, as much depending on the level of how often you touched it, correct?
Correct.
Are there any that I'm missing?
Oh. You know, I mean, I've reviewed all kinds of cases. People leave DNA in a bite mark of a cheese sandwich and a gum wrapper. You know, there's lots of ways you can you can think of trying to find. And I always tell people, if they say, hey, can I get DNA off this thing? I'm like, we won't know until we try. And so I've been surprised. We've gotten DNA from bodies that have been submerged in water for days, foreign DNA, and that always surprises me. You just don't know until you try.
So would it be fair to say that there's no real way to take any precautions to prevent your DNA from being placed on anything in particular? Would that be fair?
Oh, I think
there's objection argumentative.
Sustained.
Okay. I'll rephrase. In other words, DNA has a lot of fluidity.
Movement-wise,
movement.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of ways and manners in which your DNA, whether you mean it or not, inadvertently or intentionally, can be placed on items with even the most limited amount of contact. Would that be fair?
Yes. It's not always the case, but you test it and you see. Yes.
Okay. And Judge, at this...
Yeah, I apologize. We do have a request for a break.
And Judge, I was going to do that. I'm going to be getting into an area that I think maybe we would, we could take our break. I would ask Dr. Hempinking to please show up again after lunch.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and take the lunch recess at this time. We'll recess from 12 to 1, be back on for additional testimony at 1 o'clock. Thank you.
All right, Pete.
Thank you. We've got our jurors lined up, so please remain standing. We'll have them enter the courtroom.
All right, Pete. Here's our officer counter for you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Please be seated. All right, Mr. Pryor, you may continue. We are back on the record on KCR 2221-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell. We took the lunch recess. We're back on the record with additional testimony. Dr. Hampikian is on the stand. I'll remind the witness you're still under oath for your testimony. And Mr. Pryor, you may continue with your direct if you wish. You may.
Good afternoon, Dr. Hampikian.
Good afternoon.
I think where we left off is I was going to start talking up the testing procedures that were conducted in this particular group of evidence that you were provided. Mm-hmm. And before we do that, can you then identify, if to the best of your recollection, what evidence you looked at and what did it encompass?
I was supplied with a number of documents and electronic files. The things that are most important to me are the electronic files with the DNA data, because we have our own software that we can review that through and do probabilities and interpretations from. But I also receive things like, you know, CVs and laboratory records that we review, and then a list of evidence, a lot of which wasn't tested. So I have, you know, there are dozens of items on these lists of evidence, and what's most important is the things that were tested. And so for those, I have reports of from three laboratories, Bode Laboratories, Astrea, and the Idaho State Police Forensic Lab. And along with those, we have electronic records that allow us to reanalyze if we need to, if there's any problems. And I can't remember what other documents. There's a large packet of things that come through, but really it's the biological evidence that I pay most attention to.
And in regard to the state lab, you read a report which described a number of hairs on a piece of adhesive. Do you recall that tape?
Yeah, there were more than a dozen hairs, as I recall, but a lot of hairs.
And do you recall the different colors of those hairs on that adhesive?
Brown. There was a very short, dark hair, a blonde hair. Those are the ones I remember. And obviously there were a number of the dark hairs, and I think several of blonde hairs.
And at some point, as a result of on that tape and those hairs, and you said over a dozen hairs on that tape?
I don't know if they were all from that tape, but there are a bunch of hairs listed and only a few went on to testing. So.
Okay, and when you talk about that, the state lab is not the agency that's going to test that. Is that correct?
The state lab tests hairs generally when there's a root on them, but some of these other tests where there's no root, it's just the hair shaft, there are labs like Bode and Astrea, both of the other two labs that will process those and get really good results from hairs without roots.
And is it possible to obtain DNA from hairs without roots?
Yeah, just about, just a few years ago, 3-4 years ago, they started advertising this at some of the private labs that police agencies use, like Bode. And then Astrea is one of the newer companies that specializes in particularly in hairs that don't have roots.
Okay, so as far as Astrea is concerned, the only thing that you have in terms of Astrea is that of the brown hairs, the blonde hairs, and the short hair, the brown hairs were sent over for testing to Astrea. Is that what you recall?
Not all of them, but for some reason, certain ones were selected. Okay. And as I recall, 4 test hairs went to Astrea. Their first test is to do what's called a low depth sequencing. So they're basically just going to sequence parts of the 3 billion bases, not the whole thing. And that's because it's cheaper and it takes less computer time. And they can then tell you if the hairs are sufficient to go on further. So from that first shallow sequencing that they do, they get what they call a mitochondrial haplotype. They get some information about DNA we get from our mothers. And in that short sequencing, and the first thing they can do, they can tell if hairs are different from each other. And so they did that with the 4 hairs.
Did they compare those hairs on the ones that they sent to Astrea against any, and I'm not sure what the proper term is, people or
references,
I'm sorry, I struggled for the word.
So there are 3 references that were sent to Astrea: Chad Daybell, Lori Vallow, and JJ. And so those were the only 3 references that went through the type of testing that Astrea does. So this is a very particular type of testing, a sequence testing different than what the state lab does currently. And so they could only compare it to those 3 samples, the 4 hairs that they had. They determined from the 4 hairs, that shallow sequencing, that 2 of the hairs came from possibly the same person. So they had 3 different people out of 4 hairs, and then they compared it to the 3 references they had, and all of the reference samples were excluded from each of those 4 hairs that represent 3 people. So neither Chad Daybell nor Lori Vallow nor JJ contributed those hairs. And then there's further analysis than they did, but that's the first main conclusion, is there's 3 different people who don't match the 3 reference samples who left hairs that were sent to Astrea.
So at this point, what was basically sent to Astrea, the conclusion is that Chad Daybell was excluded as providing any of the hairs that were provided to Astrea as a positive. Would that be fair?
Yes.
Did you find any evidence of anything that you provided, that were provided to you through these DNA reports, indicating that Chad Daybell's DNA was present on anything?
No.
I want to talk to you about conclusions and you know, what type of conclusions someone in your field of DNA forensics can arrive at. And if you would talk a little bit about that, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. And these common types of tests, there's basically 3 conclusions. I can say someone is excluded. And in other words, there's too many mismatches. And I can just say it's clearly not this reference sample that donated DNA to this evidence sample. So that's exclusion. And sometimes a statistic is provided, but it's not required. You can just say they're excluded and show the data. The other option that's informational is that they cannot be excluded. So that means they could have contributed that DNA on the evidence. And then we have to supply a statistic. Is it 1 out of 2 people would match it? You know, what's the coincidental match? Is it 1 out of 100 trillion? And the third option is you can say it's inconclusive. So you can have exclusion, cannot be excluded with a statistic, inconclusive. When is it inconclusive? I drop a tube in lab. There's nothing in the tube. The test doesn't work. I doubt the results somehow. And that's an inconclusive. So those are the 3 options that we have.
Okay. And then When you get a conclusion that it's a negative result, what does that mean?
That's a really bad term because it means that what's negated is the hypothesis that was being tested. So, for example,
explain that to me. When you say what's negated is the hypothesis being tested.
Let's say someone is accused of a crime and I swab a handle of a knife, let's say. I have a reference sample from the accused. And really what I'm doing is hypothesizing that the reference sample matches the evidence sample. And I test that hypothesis. And a negative result means, in some ways, the way a lot of analysts use it, means that I've negated that hypothesis. It is not this person. It is an exclusion. So the unfortunate thing is negative result is used when we exclude someone, which is a perfectly valid result. And it's also used when it's inconclusive. Sometimes people say it was a negative result. You can think of it like a COVID test or a pregnancy test. You can be negative for the pregnancy or the disease, or the test could not work. And some people will sometimes refer to that as negative. There was no evidence. There's no test. But in the case of the labs, what they're really doing when they have a reference sample, as they had in this case, they had three reference samples, for example, at Estrella, they're testing the hypothesis.
Hypothesis in this case are they testing?
Did Lori Vallow contribute the hair? Did Chad Daybell contribute the hair? Did JJ contribute the hair? So they tested three hypotheses. And in each case, got a negative, a valid, very sensitive and correct answer that none of those people contributed those hairs. So that's how negative is used in that setting.
Is it used in other settings as well?
Yeah, and like I said, it's a tricky term the way people use it. So sometimes there's a phrase in our field, if I can say it, it's that the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. So you can't prove you weren't somewhere just because they didn't find you there. That sounds like it's true. And I've heard experts like myself say it on the stand. And years ago, I was asked on the stand, isn't it true? The absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. And then I realized, no, it is the evidence of absence. Of course, it's the evidence. And I know that because in cases where we've done exonerations, there's evidence that other people did the crime. And to say that, you know, just because there's no evidence from an innocent person, that's meaningless. It is meaningful. Things are tested. You test the hypothesis. Objection narratives.
Yeah. Sustained.
Sorry. Sorry.
So again, if I could ask a question.
Yeah.
The hypothesis you were talking about is in regards to the absence of evidence and how it relates to the testing procedures. Is that correct?
Sometimes negative results are referred to as the absence of evidence, and that's incorrect. These are well done, carefully done tests that negate a hypothesis. Did this person contribute? And that's important evidence.
Okay. So if I understand you correctly, it's not just showing that his DNA or her DNA is not on anything. It's the fact that the hypothesis suggesting that that person in some way contributed to whatever is being tested has been negated, and that the hypothesis that that person has been involved in that is negated as well.
Objection, argumentative.
Sustained.
Is the hypothesis that the person is present is negated by an absence of evidence?
Objection, argumentative.
Overruled.
I would state it this way, that every piece of evidence can be weighed in terms of, does it favor one explanation or another? And so when we have a test where someone is excluded, that some people will refer to as negative, when we have a test where someone is excluded, it's up to the triers of fact to decide what hypotheses that favors, but it's evidence when someone is excluded. It's evidence when someone is included. The only thing that's not evidence is the inconclusive. You just forget about that one. But in this positive and negative are important conclusions.
But would it be fair to say that in this particular case, there's an absence of Mr. Daybell's DNA on any of the items that you reviewed?
Yes, there's an absence of his evidence, okay. of his sample, of his DNA.
And before we finish up, I would just like to touch on the fact that were the results that you reviewed in this case, were they valid?
Yeah, we check all their controls. And so they, you know, anytime the lab's running a bunch of tests, they have some blank tubes with just the chemicals to make sure nobody's skin cells from the lab or the police got in there or whatever. And so the controls that we use in this case were standard controls at all three labs, and they all were okay. They were fine controls. So that's trustworthy.
They follow the proper testing procedures.
They follow the proper procedures, and they got good results with their controls.
They searched for the smallest or tiniest amount of DNA?
Very small amounts of DNA they searched for.
Significantly small?
I mean, you know, as small as they can go. So generally, we're looking at just a few cells now. So, okay. You know. 20, 40 cells.
Is there any indication that anything went wrong with their testing procedures?
No.
And they had all the proper controls?
Yes.
Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about with your familiarity with these testing labs. Do you have some sort of familiarity with Astria?
Yes. Yeah. I know Dr. Ed Green, who's helped me on a particular case. His technology, I believe, helped found that company.
Okay.
So I helped him with his, I gave him his first case, really.
You gave him his first case?
I believe it was, yeah.
Okay.
It's here in Idaho, too.
And you know Bode Laboratory?
I've been to Bode many times, or several times, and I was just on a panel or on a DNA panel with people from Bode, so I know some of those folks who work there.
And the state police as well?
I know the state police folks pretty well. I see them at professional meetings. I visited the lab on occasion. Yeah.
So if I understand correctly, then you don't have any question about the procedures that they followed. Is that correct? What you question is maybe the range of what they decided to test.
I don't know who makes those decisions about what's being tested. I just know what ultimately gets tested. And in this case, four hairs were sent to Astraea. The very short dark hair, it was called, and then the rest of them were brown hairs, three other brown hairs.
And then the hairs that weren't sent included blonde hairs.
That's correct.
Okay. Judge, I have nothing else. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Wood, when you're ready, cross-examination.
Good afternoon, Dr. Hampikian.
Good afternoon.
So you testified, you do run a lab at VSU.
I do.
Is that an accredited forensic laboratory?
Not for the type of evidence the state police run, no.
Okay.
Mr. Wood, I apologize for the interruption. Could I have a quick sidebar with counsel, please? The court wanted to clarify the matter, and I am allowing a brief reopening of the direct in order to address that exhibit, and then we'll go back to cross. So, Mr. Pryor, you may approach. Yes, and this relates to the proposed Exhibit 49A.
And, Judge, at this time, I'd move, and my understanding is by stipulation, to the admission of Exhibit 49A.
Okay, and that's the Astraea report. Does the state have any objection to the admission of Exhibit 49A defense?
No objection.
Okay.
Thank you.
Exhibit 49A is admitted. Thank you, Mr.
President. And I'm done, Judge. Thank you.
All right. And sorry, on this exhibit again, do we have a separate 49 and 49A?
Well, I believe there's a 49 and there's a 49A, Judge.
Okay. Well, 49A is now admitted, which is paper copy of an Astraea report. Thank you while we sort that out. Apologies for the interruption, Mr. Wood. You can commence and begin again or continue where you left off on your cross.
Thank you. Dr. Hampikian?
Yes.
Hello again.
Hi.
So you testified you do run a lab.
Yes.
But for actual testing in a criminal case, you would send that off to someone else.
We do now, yeah.
Was there a time when you tested it?
Yes, there was.
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, you testified this lab you run that was not a an accredited forensic lab anymore, or it is not a forensic
lab. We never applied for the type of accreditation that Bode and Astraea and the ISP lab have. We use the same procedure, same equipment, but we're an academic lab, and so we're not required to do that unless we wanted to take in, you know, paid testing, which I don't want to do.
And you have a lot of students in your lab.
Yeah, I think six right now that are this summer.
Mr. Pryor spoke with you about the ISP testing.
Yes.
And did you review all of the lab reports for that testing?
I reviewed all I was given. I think I had all the reports, yeah.
Okay. Did you review the test identifying the remains of Tylee Ryan?
Yes.
And you had no issues with that testing?
No.
Okay. Did you review the results of the test identifying J.J. Vallow?
Yes.
And to be fair, it identified him to his biological father, Dennis Trahan, correct?
I believe. I can't remember, but it was a correct identification.
Okay. Yeah. So you didn't have any problem with that testing?
None at all.
Mm-hmm. All right. Did you review the testing of what appeared to be genetic material in the eye of a pickaxe?
Yes.
And did that testing, was it valid to you?
Yes.
On that same pickaxe, there was some testing done on what appeared to be a blood spot. Did you review that testing?
I believe they referred to it as the handle or?
Yes.
Yeah, the handle. Yep.
And that testing was fine with you?
Yes, it was.
Okay. And finally, there was some genetic material on the blade of a shovel. Did you review that testing?
Yes.
And that testing was met criteria for you?
Yes.
And you're aware, you spoke about the Astrea lab testing. You were aware of the hair that got sent to Bodie Labs? Thank you, Your Honor. I have no further questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wood.
Again, permission, Josh?
Yes. Redirect, Mr. Pryor.
And just very briefly, Dr. Hampinki, and in regards to the axe and the shovel, your testimony is that you acknowledge that there was valid samples on those for Tylee, or for Tylee on those samples. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But isn't it true, Dr. Hampinkian, there is no accurate way to determine actually how those samples got on those tools, is there?
Not by anything that I can do with DNA.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Doctor.
Yep.
Judge, I have nothing else.
Okay, that will conclude the testimony of the witness then. Is he going to remain under subpoena by either the state or the defense, Mr. Pryor?
Judge, first. Judge, he's going to be excused.
We don't have him under subpoena.
Okay, that'll conclude your testimony. Thank you for appearing and testifying today. You can step down.
And Judge, could we take a brief sidebar again? I apologize.
Yes.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code iHeart or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code iHeart or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.